Welcome, Mzanzi. You are listening to Farmers Inside Track, proudly brought to you by Food for Mzanzi. I'm your host, Dawn Mdu. Officially, this is the world's best podcast for 2024, as awarded by WANEFRA, the global organization for the world's press. In this edition, we focus on the topic that's buzzing with importance: honeybee populations and the crucial role they play in our ecosystems and food security. Now, you may have heard the warnings about the decline in bee numbers globally, but what does it really mean for us as farmers? And how can we take action to protect these vital pollinators? To help us unpack this, we're thrilled to have not one, but two incredible guests joining us today. We have firstly Chris Nicklin, chairperson of the Western Cape Bee Industry Association, who's been at the forefront of promoting sustainable beekeeping practices and advocating for honeybee conservation. And alongside him, we have Mike Alsop, a senior researcher at the Agricultural Research Council, whose groundbreaking research on honeybee health and resilience is helping shape the future of pollinator protection in South Africa. Together, they'll walk us through the current threats facing honeybee populations, from pesticides to climate change, and share some actionable steps farmers can take to make the operations more bee-friendly. Plus, we'll hear more about the unique role the Cape honeybee plays in our local agriculture and why it's considered a rock star in the world of science. So grab a notebook and stay tuned. You won't want to miss this buzzworthy episode. Welcome to Farmers Inside Track, Mark.
Thank you.
And then I also have Chris Nicklin with me, who is the chairperson of the Western Cape Bee Industry Association. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much, Dawn.
Thank you so much for accommodating me and for chatting to us today. I am myself a new beekeeper, new in the industry, and I think it's absolutely amazing to be able to pick your brains today. Mike joining us, talking about more of the research aspect, and you, Chris, in your own right as a beekeeper and also representing the Western Cape Bee Industry Association. So I'm going to start off just by asking you, over the years, your dealings with bees and beekeeping and your research elements, maybe just a short introduction of you and what you do within the industry. Thanks.
So I'm the senior researcher at the honeybee research section in Stellenbosch for the Agricultural Research Council. Over the past 20 years, pretty much the only researcher working on bees. I've been in that post now for 35 years. I've been doing bees. I've just gone into my 40 years of doing beekeeping. How did I get into bees? I got into bees because my supervisor wouldn't pay for the equipment that I needed to work on bats when I was studying. So if you don't work on bats, you work on bees. And then once you start, you stay on it. I've been working on bees since 1984.
That's more than my lifetime.
Just gone into my 40 years of bees and been actually in the AOC and head of the research division since mid-1990s. In terms of beekeeping in general, I deal with all aspects of beekeeping, from beekeeping development programs to commercial questions, apicultural questions, to diseases and pests, to bee forage. But increasingly, we really focus on pollination more and more in terms of the economic significance of honeybees.
And of course, there's a lot of ground to cover, and I don't think we'll be able to do all of it on this podcast, but I think it's just us being able to talk a little bit about specific issues that's kind of pertinent at the moment and things that people are talking about. I mean, we hear people saying, save the bee, but what does it actually mean? And so I hope to get into that conversation. But over to you, Chris, just more about your work within the beekeeping industry. Also a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of experience. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about how your journey started.
Sure, Dawn. Bizarrely enough, I've been involved with bees and beekeeping longer than Mike, although I'm sure he's got a lot more wealth of information in comparison to me. Yeah, I started as a beekeeper as a school kid. I think I was about 10 or 11 at the time, and this was the late 1970s. And I must tell you that my schoolwork suffered as a consequence, but I became so absorbed in beekeeping, and really is a lifelong passion. I went and off and did a completely different career in the media, in South Africa and abroad, but kept an eye on the bee business all along, and I was determined that one day I would go into large-scale beekeeping. And when the opportunity arose, that's exactly what I did. But as I said, it's been a pretty much a lifelong passion, and I really believe that for people who take it up as a hobby, it is the most absorbing pursuit, and that's why it probably is so popular.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's almost like a kind of movement towards it now, where more people are more aware, they want to get into it even as hobbyists.
I think that's got a lot to do with the whole concern around the environment generally, global warming and what have you. And we've seen around the world in major cities like London and New York this huge spurt in growth in terms of urban beekeeping. So yeah, it really is a worldwide phenomenon.
And I want to stay with you for a moment, just introduce us to specifically the Western Cape and the region where beekeepers obviously operate in this province. If you can tell us a little bit about how we're doing, you know, how many beekeepers are active, if you have those statistics with you, and maybe just paint a bit of a picture of the landscape of the beekeeping industry in this province.
Look, as I say, we know it's a very popular pursuit, overwhelmingly hobbyist beekeepers, but we do have a reasonable number of commercial large-scale beekeepers, although they make up actually, as I say, quite a small percentage of the total number of beekeepers. But here in the Western Cape, we have our unique honeybee, the Cape honeybee, Apis mellifera capensis, and we're immensely privileged to be able to work with an indigenous subspecies of honeybee that occupies its own floristic kingdom, the Fynbos kingdom, the Cape Flora kingdom, which geographically is the smallest plant kingdom in the world, but species-wise is possibly the most diverse, between 9,000 and heading up to 10,000, I believe, at the moment. So if you want me to give you a diagnosis of the health of the industry in the Western Cape, it's difficult to do that because not all beekeepers are part of the Western Cape Bee Industry Association. We pretty much divide the industry up in organized beekeeping and disorganized beekeeping.
Okay. And I'm part of the organized group, people. Just full disclosure.
Good for you. And that's the way it should be, because yes. if we work as a coherent body of beekeepers, we're going to overcome a lot more of the challenges we're facing as beekeepers in the Western Cape and elsewhere in South Africa. But perhaps we can get onto that a little later, exactly what the challenges are.
Yeah, no, definitely. Now more towards the significance of the Cape honeybee and what some might refer to as the rock star of bees. Mike, over to you now, just in terms of scientific circles, you know, what sets it apart from other honeybee species, specifically in terms of its genetic traits or behavior?
So as I always highlight, in terms of its functionality, in terms of its beekeeping aspect, Apis mellifera capensis is very much the same as any other bee in the world, in terms of its capacity to produce honey and in terms of its use and viability as a pollination animal, really not massively different from any other bee population in the world. But underlying that, it's only in recent years that most beekeepers in the Cape perhaps are aware of it, and I would still say the vast majority of beekeepers are completely unaware of just how biologically interesting and significant the bee that they work with is. And it has been the focus of attention for a lot of people, for a lot of research groups from international research groups for the last 20 or 30 years, simply because it does have a whole lot of unique attributes, not entirely positive attributes. So without going into too many details, because it is quite complicated, the key aspect is that worker honeybees of the Cape honeybee are able to reproduce by something called Telotocus parthenogenesis, which means they're able to make clones of themselves, which means workers of Cape honeybees make other workers and can make queens as well, whereas workers of all other bee types in the world actually produce male offspring, drones, which essentially means that Cape workers can exist and Cape worker colonies can exist and do exist sometimes without queens, certainly for quite long periods of time. Allied to that characteristic, there are certain attributes of Cape honeybees, like the chemical signals of the workers, which are very similar to the chemical signals of queens, and their capacity to develop their ovaries very rapidly, which is tied into this ability of theirs to produce female offspring, which combined turns them into actual social parasites. The essence of it is that if you put Cape honeybees with any other bee population in the world, they will infiltrate that population, they will take over those colonies, and they will actually kill those queens and take over the reproduction of those colonies, which essentially they are a lethal social parasite to any other bee type in the world. They don't play nice with the neighbors. So the consequences of that are that we cannot bring other populations of bees into the Cape because they would just get overrun by capensis and killed by them. And equally, you cannot take capensis to anywhere else in the world because they would devastate beekeeping populations pretty much anywhere in the world, which is why they are specifically listed in legislations and regulations all around the world as completely undesirable.
What Mike has been saying, if you attempt to take a colony of Cape honeybees into the United States, you can actually be arrested on terrorism charges.
Well, but importantly, from a practical point of view, the existence of these characteristics in capensis has led to us actually dividing our country. So we have a capensis, from a regulatory point of view, we have a colloquially called the Siegfried Line, which divides South Africa into a capensis zone and a scutellata zone, and you're not allowed to move bees across that zone. And in terms of pollination demands and things like that, that is, and increasingly that's going to have all kinds of significance. But essentially for us in the Cape, it means that whatever pollination requirements we have in the Cape, we need to actually keep that number of colonies to service those demands. We cannot bring bees from elsewhere. We cannot import bees from Australia or do anything else. We actually have to be able to sustain enough bees to service our own demand.
And are we servicing our own demands? Chris, if you could maybe come in there just as part of giving us an overview of if it's actually working.
Are we talking about honey production?
Honey production in terms of pollination specifically now, in terms of what Mike is saying, in terms of that aspect that it's difficult. We have to grow as an industry and kind of be sustainable for ourselves to be able to do what we need to do in this province specifically.
So when Bill Clinton was running for the presidency in the United States a couple of decades ago, he famously said, it's the economy, stupid. But here in the Western Cape, and I guess in the rest of South Africa, it's all about the forage, stupid.
Yeah.
Forage shortage is our number one challenge in the Western Cape. And this is why beekeepers pursue apiary sites so assiduously, and they protect them and they keep them secret, because there simply is not enough forage to meet the needs of the number of managed colonies that we require for pollination. They reckon that in a few years' time, we simply won't have enough managed hives because we don't have enough forage to feed them outside the pollination season. I don't think anybody knows exactly when that will be, but it is a unpleasant scenario that is being painted. And possibly Mike has a better idea about the growth of pollination units in the Western Cape. So to answer your question, is at the moment we're managing to meet pollination needs, and the reality is our agricultural economy is growing exponentially all the time, and new crops are being introduced by farmers, such as almonds in the last few years, which are heavy dependence on pollination units. And we'll probably see more crops being introduced into the Western Cape that will require honeybee pollination. So it's really a case of, when do we get to that critical point that we just don't have enough colonies to provide the pollination services to meet the pollination needs? On the honey front, unfortunately, over the last 20, 30 years, and we began this discussion by mentioning when I first began beekeeping, I think 30 years ago or so, we were able to produce probably an average of 20 kilograms of honey per hive. We're down to roughly 10, 15 kilograms, so probably even less than that, sometimes only 7 kilograms, sometimes in hives, not at all. So there's very clear evidence we don't have enough forage, and that's why I say forage to produce honey. And that's why I say the forage issue is so critical, and therefore beekeeping is at a kind of crossroads in the Western Cape and, in fact, in South Africa.
I mean, there's a lot of drive for this change. I mean, there's a lot of projects, funding, driving kind of ways to support, you know, the growth of more forage, working in conservation projects. WWF is working on, you know, various aspects of that. There's a forage fund that's in the talks about kind of encouraging also beekeepers themselves being more aware. So hopefully, I mean, we're able to turn that around and we can actually see this change coming about, at least in our lifetime.
In 2018, and Mike can speak more authoritatively about this, the Western Cape government initiated something called the Bee Industry Strategy. The primary goal encapsulated a lot of critical areas in the world of beekeeping and apiculture, but one of the main problem areas to tackle was the forage issue. But unfortunately, that really hasn't taken off as we would have hoped.
Yes.
I think there were a lot of lofty ideals attached to that, to the credit of the people who put together the strategy. But I just think that it was a very complex strategy that just hasn't gained traction for many reasons.
Mike, if I could bring you back into the conversation, just talking about again about the adaptability of the Cape honeybee and for them to kind of adapt to specific environments and conditions. And you can also comment on what Chris was saying.
I think we're very close to the tipping point. We were right on the tipping point. I forget exactly which year was the last year of the dry cycle, the last dry cycle in the Western Cape. I think it was 2019 or 2020 when we had, in that last year of the previous dry cycle, there was already a shortfall. There were growers that actually were unable to get enough pollination. Through the last 4 years or so of the wet cycle, bee numbers have increased substantially, and there seem to be about 40%, I would guess that's a thumbsuck figure, but there tends to be about 40% more bees during the wet cycles than the dry cycles. But pollination demand is increasing at least 15 to 20% per annum in the Western Cape and nationally, and climate change is going to push new crops into the Western Cape, crops that we previously didn't have, macadamias and mangoes and things like that, that require bees. And as Chris said, almonds, there's huge expanse in almonds. They're planting as many almonds as they possibly can. I definitely think we are very much on a tipping point in terms of the amount of colonies that we can provide to service pollination. Even more importantly, we actually have to look at exactly when these crops require pollination. So getting pollination for pumpkins, etc., which is in February, that's not a problem. Even doing onions in November, that's not a problem. But if you look in August, everything needs, you know, you've got the early plums and you've got apricots and you've got almonds. There's going to be bottlenecks when there just is not enough pollination.
Mike, as you know, we've had a very difficult pollination season this year. And in fact, because of the very cold and wet winter, a lot of the fruit cultivars were flowering at different times. And there was almost a pretty much a perfect storm of different fruits blossoming at the same period. Beekeepers were having to jump around.
Do you think that this means that there will be a growth in the number of beekeepers that operate, that can operate to service, or is that still something? Still a very small number, and that's just the number that we'll have to do all those
things. Yeah, it's the issue of pollination is a lot more complex than just simply taking beehives into the nurtured. Beehives have to be specifically prepared for pollination to ensure that they are at their optimal for pollination. And I won't go into the details of that because it can be quite complex. Just as I say, it's not just a question of just taking any old hive into the orchards or the fields. A hive has to be properly prepared by an expert beekeeper. That's really what it takes. So beekeepers have to be experienced people. You can't just rope in any beekeeper to do pollination job.
The key is, as Chris says, it's all about the forage. So you create the forage, then you create capacity for more beekeeping. The only industry that actually is sensibly compared to trying to manage the beekeeping industry, it's not like growing wheat or growing maize or whatever. It's marine fishing, that there is literally a finite size of the population, and you need quotas and you need to allocate those things. There is only so many fish in the sea. There are literally only so many fish in the sea. And then you get changes that take place that are beyond the scope of influence of the fishermen, like climate change or currents, etc., and that can completely change the situation. The only thing that actually genuinely moves the needle in terms of the capacity of beekeepers in the Western Cape or in the country or globally is to actually increase what I always used to call the chocolate cake, which is the amount of forage. You actually have to build a bigger cake. If you want more beekeepers, you have to have a bigger cake.
And knowledge transfer, I think, is also very important.
South Africa is currently producing less than 20% of the honey it consumes. So we're importing 80% of the honey. That clearly is an unstable situation. It's clearly reflective of a situation where the whole industry is actually vulnerable if you suddenly don't have that honey. And there are many beekeepers now, commercial beekeepers, that are not producing honey at all. Whatever honey their hives are producing, they're just feeding back into the hives to actually, their currency now is bees, and that's not honey.
Dawn, what I wanted to mention is that whenever you introduce yourself as a large-scale or commercial beekeeper, people automatically assume honey production is your focus, whereas pollination really is the essential service that the beekeeping industry provides to agriculture in South Africa. It's estimated that about 50 food crops in South Africa are dependent on honeybee pollination. And as Mike mentioned earlier, and possibly growing given the changes in the climates, beekeeping makes an absolutely, literally unquantifiable contribution to agriculture in terms of ensuring we get the food security that we need as a country, that we're able to export food, And that also, you know, provides employment in the rural areas. If it wasn't for the honeybee pollinators, we'd obviously have a lot less agricultural capacity. So we can never underestimate the essential role that honeybees play.
No, definitely. That's where the question kind of comes in, and kind of this mission saying, save the bees, save the bees. And everyone kind of talks about it broadly, but really understanding it is, I think, what the message that we should be sharing and hoping to with this podcast specifically. If I could go back to the kind of rock starness of our Cape honeybee and maybe talk a little bit about the bee itself as part of the conversation for you, Mike, just talking about pests and diseases comes into play in all agricultural commodities, and whether you're working with bees or other livestock, if we can just talk a little bit about the relative resistance to some pests and diseases that our bees in the Cape specifically have. And if you could elaborate on why this is the case, maybe talk a little bit about, you know, their biology and their behavior that makes them resistant compared to other bees.
Well, that's actually all ties in with the commercial side and with our type, with the nature of our beekeeping. I don't think that there's any significant data that says that Cape honeybees are better in terms of pests and disease than other African bees. They might be marginally different, but this is a general characteristic of all African bees. The more probably all 13 subspecies of African bees, but certainly the sub-Saharan ones. At its core, it's two features. Basically, it's some straight behavioral attributes of African bees, things like that they've got faster generational time and shorter post-capping time when the brood is capped, which actually makes them less susceptible to certain parasites and pests, etc. But more than that, the essence of the tolerance that we are seeing in African bee populations is that they are unmanaged, is that they are unmanipulated, unselected. So they have had to survive a high level of what we might consider irritation pests like wax moth and hive beetles, etc. And because our population of bees is essentially a wild population, and it's still 80 or 90% of the bee colonies in Africa or unmanaged or wild colonies, they are not being looked after by people. They're not being given treatments or pesticides or chemicals or anything. So they have to survive by themselves. So they have the behavioral wherewithal to manage these pests and diseases, which has allowed them to actually, when exotic pests have arrived, those same behavioral attributes has given them a kickstart, a head start, and been able to manage those new problems. In comparison, in other places in the world, Europe in particular, where they've bred bees for the last 500 years, and if you look at any of my talks over the last 20 years, etc., I always put up a picture of your black and tan dog, which you find in rural populations everywhere, which is basically wild-type dogs. And if humans just disappear, dogs will automatically go straight back to black and tans. That's basically the wild-type dog. And you compare that, and I always put up a picture with a black and tan and then a beautiful little white fluffy poodle. And the history of beekeeping over the last 600 years, particularly in Europe, particularly in Germany, is they've bred out a whole lot of attributes. They've bred out swarming. They've bred out defensiveness. They've changed the animal. They've domesticated honeybees to make them much easier for people to keep them, so that you can keep them without them attacking you, without them stinging you. And at the same time, they've actually removed their capacity to look after themselves. So now hive beetles or wax moth or anything else actually are critical threats to them. In contrast, our bee population is basically Zotiza ratels, basically as it has always been. We don't have really massively intensive beekeeping where there's thousands of colonies together. So it's small apiaries around the place. And we have to be very sensitive to that. That golden goose, which underlies everything about African beekeeping, and the fact that everywhere you talk about save the bees, well, there is no saving the bees in Africa. African bees are not under threat. They are doing perfectly well. No one is concerned about saving the bees everywhere in Africa. If we actually get to the stage where our demand for bees is such that we actually have to keep them at an industrial scale, and that we can only keep them by feeding them huge amounts of food and keeping them in warehouses, basically factory farming bees, we will lose those attributes that we currently have, and we will make our bee population as susceptible to pests and diseases as bee populations everywhere else around the world. So we have to guard against actually developing our beekeeping to the extent that we actually lose those attributes which makes African bees currently, we laugh at the pests in the world.
I think there's so much that we can still talk about. And for the sake of time, I want to kind of start looking towards the future and just touch on briefly what you were saying, Chris, in terms of growth of our food and obviously the need for bees and kind of how do we manage the threats like pesticides, climate change and other factors of how pesticides are affecting bee populations and farm beekeepers and farmers working together and kind of ensuring that that relationship is sustainable. And I was at a workshop the other day and beekeepers were really complaining about how they farmers are just spraying for pests and they're really struggling, losing colonies. So how do we balance the need for crop protection with bee conservation?
And it goes back to the issue of what I say is the importance of unity among beekeepers. Mm-hmm. We can no longer as beekeeping associations just be this little cozy club where we share tips on how to wire frames and what's the best fuel for your smoker. We have to be a lobbying group effectively.
Yes.
Against these myriad challenges that we face as an industry. You know, I don't want to use the old cliche, strength in numbers, but it's absolutely essential that we as a beekeeping body in this country and nationwide, not just the Western Cape, the industry is subdivided into regional beekeeping associations, but that we really do have to speak with one voice and confront the challenges right from national government level down to provincial and local government level. And you mentioned the issue of pesticides, and it really is a problem for us because we do come across a lot of incidents where accidental or reckless, we don't know. But what is the unfortunate reality is that a lot of pesticides that are being used in South Africa, legally, mind you, are outlawed in other parts of the world. And we really need to get our rules and regulations around pesticides use in line with other parts of the world, like the European Union, for example, because I know that we are using pesticides that, as I say, that are banned in the EU, but allowed here in agriculture, not necessarily in domestic household use, but still permitted to be used in agriculture. So we as a beekeeping organization have to lobby against those kind of anomalies in South Africa that ultimately do impact on the health and welfare of our indigenous honeybee population.
Yeah, and I think a big part of it is, you know, encouraging people to understand the industry and to be part of it and participate, even if it's just reading up and understanding better how they can contribute, irrespective of whether they're in it or not. Over to you, Mike, just to comment on what Chris was saying and then just kind of looking towards the future, specifically around conservation and what efforts are currently in place to conserve the Cape honeybee for its continued survival. You spoke earlier about breeding, but are there any other breeding programs or research initiatives or that can kind of be focused on the species and kind of ensuring that it survives?
So with respect to the pesticide issues, et cetera, I actually differ somewhat from Chris's perspective on this. I'm not convinced that we should be following the EU example in terms of the products that they've banned. The EU went on this mission to ban nicotinoids, et cetera, in the late 2015s, et cetera. Their pesticide losses had quadrupled since then, because it has forced farmers to go back to organophosphate and old plant protection products. And their own data shows it, that it has actually made the situation in Europe much worse than it was. The reality is that plant protection products, pesticides, are there to kill things. That's what they're there for. And if you want to grow agricultural, industrial-level foods, you cannot grow them without these products. And we need to actually work with the pesticide companies to actually make them safer and better, and rather than trying to actually ban newly developed products. It's all about enforcement, all about making sure that they're being used appropriately and as they're supposed to be used. If I was going to make a comment on the South African situation, that's where our problem is. We don't have sufficient evaluation of the products and we don't have sufficient infrastructure to actually respond to when you have these incidents. If I was going to take something from Europe, etc., they have compensation schemes and they have evaluation schemes where the moment there is anyone is suspected of using a product incorrectly, then you can pick up the phone, you can call people, people will come and collect samples, they will actually collect samples from your bees and from the plants, and they will do all their evaluation and they will take appropriate action if anyone is found to be committing offence. within a South African context, whenever we have pesticide issues, the beekeeper actually has to do all that themselves. There is no one to phone. There is no system in place. So beekeepers who have hives poisoned basically face the prospect of actually having to spend 100,000 rand or 300,000 rand on analysis of samples without any guarantee that they're going to get this back, which is why no one actually does it and they just walk away from the losses and try and avoid it. So we need to actually build the infrastructure. It's not about the pesticides, it's about managing them correctly, which we don't have in South Africa. In terms of the Cape honeybee and protection, most people don't know this, but once upon a time, there was a huge mission to actually save the Cape honeybee. And we had a project, this is before I started, there was a project which was looking at, they were threatened with extinction, that they were going to be driven to extinction by a Cutelata. We had a project to work out where the last remnants of the Cape honeybees were so that they could actually have national Cape honeybee sanctuaries to protect them. But they subsequently found that they are actually lethal parasites of everything else and that you basically had to protect all the other bees from them. At present, there are no breeding programs or protection mechanisms current or envisaged to protect the Cape honeybee. For the most part, I think the population and the characteristic which defines Cape honeybees is pretty much self-sustainable and protects itself. I don't think they particularly need protection. Beekeeping in general probably needs assistance. I think the bees themselves are fine.
The bees themselves are fine. That's very good to know. As I wrap up, I just want to get your last comments, Chris, just in terms of how you envision the future of the industry in your position as chair of this specific body, but also as a beekeeper yourself. What do you think the next 10 to 20 years will look like for us?
Sitting where I am now, it's not a very optimistic outlook. And it's not only just lack of forage. We have really problematic issues around theft and vandalism of beehives in rural areas. Unfortunately, when beekeepers attempt to report the losses of hives, the complaints are not taken very seriously. It's pretty rare for anybody to be charged and actually face some kind of custodial sentence for the theft of beehives. Unfortunately, beehives, by and large, they're kept in remote rural areas, so they're extremely vulnerable. It's a major issue. So coupled with, as we were discussing earlier, the forage, the theft and vandalism, the decline in honey outputs because of the forage issue, greater economic pressures per se on beekeepers. It's a tough industry to be in. South Africa is not a beekeeping friendly country for all sorts of reasons. And when you say that to people, they look aghast at you, sort of wondering what you're meaning. But it's, as I say, it's to do with our relative lack of forage. If I think of a country like Greece, for example, which geographically speaking is probably a fifth of the size of South Africa, yet they produce 20,000 tons of honey a year, as opposed to our paltry 2,000 tons a year. It's an industry with a lot of challenges ahead, but a whole lot of things have to come together to create a better outlook, because it is such a pivotal, as we were talking earlier, it is such a crucial cog in the agricultural economy of this area. But in order to overcome these challenges, we have to find a way of working together as beekeepers across South Africa and being taken more seriously by government, because very often the message isn't getting through about the role that bees and beekeeping play in our overall economy, especially around issues of food security.
I would like to still stay hopeful as someone that's just stepping into the industry, but I think we have to be realistic.
Fascinating hobby. And you may go on to become a commercial beekeeper.
Inshallah.
And you may find that you enjoy the challenges. It's undeniable that it's a fascinating pursuit.
Yes.
We have to live with, as I say, quite a few challenges.
Yeah. My just last comment, and this is more around your brain as a scientist. So bees are now classified as small livestock, as I understand it. They used to form under the plant sciences, but now they're small livestock. How does that kind of come into play when we talk about the entire industry at the moment, especially around regulations and things? Just as I understand it, there's some regulations with exporting and how we export, if we export.
So you're going to have to ask Delard for the actual update on this. But as far as that's the plan, and I have seen some recent texts to suggest that is happening, but it has not happened as yet. Department of Agriculture was essentially divided into plant health and to animal health. And there were things that impacted plants put under plants. So locusts and quileas and bees, etc., were all fell under animal health. And then that was literally enshrined in the Act. You actually had, by law, veterinarians were not allowed to treat invertebrates. And that remains the case. They, in terms of the Animal Products Act, they're not allowed to treat invertebrates, which put us at odds with everywhere else in the world, and everywhere else in the world where we, what used to be called the OIE, they have all the rules that govern animal products in terms of exports and sales, and those are all governed by veterinary health certificates. But we had the situation in South Africa that our vets could not actually, were not allowed by law to actually monitor or manage our colonies, which stopped us exporting to other places in the world. That is being addressed. Legislation, changes in legislation do take a bit of time. So I think it will take at least 3 years before that is properly addressed. From what I see, they've managed to find themselves an interim solution at the moment to allow us to do exports. But definitely moving bees into animal health actually aligns us with the rest of the world and probably will actually result in quite a lot of changes in how honeybees are managed in South Africa, because vets tend to manage things differently. But there's progress in that direction.
Dawn, could I just interject here? On a reasonably positive note, and it, in a way, ties in what Mike has just had to say, for the first time, our two indigenous honeybee subspecies are being included in what's called the National Biodiversity Assessment, along with Mopani worms, which we know have been revered for generations for their protein value. But it's significant now that honeybees are being incorporated in this assessment, which is carried out by the South African National Biodiversity Institute. And in many respects, I think it's going to be a long haul before we start getting a realistic picture of things. Say they should be able to provide us with a good snapshot of the overall state of the bee populations in South Africa.
Thank you so much for your insights. Chris Nicklin, chairperson of the Western Cape Bee Industry Association, and Mike Alsop, a senior researcher at the Agricultural Research Council. For more updates on optimizing your agricultural practices, visit www.foodfromzanzi.co.za. Remember to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with fellow agriculture enthusiasts. From me, Dawn Numdu, our technical producer, Megan van der Vent, and the rest of the hashtag Team Food from Zanzi, until next time, happy farming.